I'd like to welcome everybody, and also just a brief reminder to turn off all pagers, cell phones, courtesy and also, let me introduce you our speaker. Nancy Cater. Nancy was born and raised in Ogden, Utah, and spent many years as a registered nurse, working in critical care settings in hospitals, including LDS Hospital in Salt Lake City and Utah Valley Hospital in Provo. She earned her BS in nursing at BYU in 1967. In the late 1990s, she returned to school to study philosophy and bioethics, earning her PhD in 2005 in philosophy from the University of Maryland College Park. She now works as a consultant in bioethics, has published an article in the field, and serves on a health policy board in Fairfax County, Virginia, where she resides with her husband, Omar, a former professor of international relations at BYU. And also, she plays the piano in society. And now I'd like you to turn the time over to Nancy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming so early in the morning. I want to give you a little bit of a heads up about what I hope to do at the very end, is leave 5 or 10 minutes, at least, I hope, to talk about why Mormons would be involved in torture. And I'm very curious about whether or not you feel, like I do, that they should maybe be held to a little bit of a higher sort of Christianity than the average person. On the other hand, many people complain, why are Mormons singled out just because they're Mormons? They're doing the same things other people are doing. So we'll see what you think about it. Maybe you can be thinking of that during the early part of my talk, and we'll see. I'm going to read just a little bit of the first 2 pages. I'm not going to read anything other than that, but maybe that'll just help us get started in the to give you my hook about this, which is that long before 9/11 and long before the beginning of the War on Terror, an assault upon the Constitution began, and it was primarily instigated by Vice President Cheney and his like-minded colleagues, and it was known as the Unitary Executive Theory. Many of you may have heard of this, many of you may not. Ironically, the legal support structure to support this new interpretation of our Constitution was created by members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I'm going to name specifically Timothy Flanagan and Jay Bybee. And some of you know them, and some of you may not, but they've all lived in this area, or both of them have lived in this area. The reason I say ironically, Mormons have always claimed the highest regard for the Constitution and insist that it's divinely inspired. Back in our earliest days, Orson Hyde warned that the Constitution was inspired, raised by God, and built upon heavenly principles. Our folk culture in the LDS Church has long worried that the Constitution could be weakened or put in danger of outright collapse by some combination of internal stress, warfare, or dire influence. Indeed, it is often said that the Constitution will someday hang by a thread. You've all heard that, right? It will require the elders of Zion to step up to save it. This prophecy is known as the White Horse Prophecy, and it's attributed to Joseph Smith, but it's considered to be a folk prophecy because while it's often cited, its roots are quite obscure. It's not been formally accepted by the church leadership. It was never recorded firsthand, but it's been passed down by many who claim to have heard it from the lips of Joseph and often jotted it down in a diary. Orson Hyde said, Joseph Smith declared that the time would come when the Constitution would be in danger of an overthrow, and said he, if the Constitution be saved at all, it will be by the elders of this church. In a more current discussion, even in the Encyclopedia of LDS History, they refer to the idea as an interesting long-term theme in church teachings, that the Constitution will become so endangered that it will hang by a thread, only to be rescued by the faithful elders. It was referred to so often by Brigham Young and the other leaders that it indicates that some kind of language must have been used by Joseph Smith. Well, one of the most highly valued features of our Constitution is the separation of powers. That's when the executive, legislative, and judicial branches keep tabs on one another. That's so important that all of us in school learn that very young. Our most right-wing former prophet of the church, Ezra Taft Benson, found that separation of powers to be the most fundamental stipulation of the Constitution, which guaranteed our freedom. He also seemed to be referring to the White Horse Prophecy when he wrote this pamphlet, which I still have, from 1986, called The Constitution, A Heavenly Banner. And he wrote, "We are fast approaching that moment prophesied by Joseph Smith when he said, 'Even this nation will be on the very verge of crumbling to pieces and tumbling to the ground. And when the Constitution is upon the brink of ruin, this people will be the staff upon which the nation shall lean, and they shall bear the Constitution away from the very verge of destruction.'" And his citation is Church Historian's Office, which sounds as though there must be something put away that he knew about that maybe the rest of us didn't. So how did it come about that two faithful and active priesthood holders in the church who have right-wing politics, very similar to that that Ezra Taft Benson would have espoused, are now despised for endangering our Constitution and threatening the separation of powers doctrine by their radical legal interpretations? These two men in high positions in the Bush administration wrote the secretive memos that helped them to plan to write and to execute the Bush-Cheney doctrines that the mainstream legal community believe are well out of the mainstream. They are radical. They endanger the very values we hold dear in America. Furthermore, their legal writings led to explicit harm. War, wiretapping of American citizens without warrant, eavesdropping, long-term imprisonment without trial, unprecedented secrecy as to their actions, and last but not least, illegal torture. They now face possible war crimes prosecutions, maybe criminal prosecutions. They could even face the inability to travel outside our borders due to a fear of being prosecuted by the International Criminal Courts for war crimes. Now, in case you think I'm being too harsh on them, I do want to just disclaim, I'm acquainted with both of them, at least briefly. I've met Jay Bybee, don't really know him. Tim Flanagan I know really well. He's been in my ward for 10 or 15 years until he moved away a few years ago. And both of these men are admired by most people who know them, well thought of, active in church, responsible, have good families. And so the critique that I'm making today is not about their persons in any sort of way. And I've taken all my quotes solely from newspaper, magazine, and online reports in the public domain. Well, from the benefit of hindsight, we can now state categorically that the consuming idea that they had, which was to expand presidential powers beyond anything seen before in our country, excluding the legislative and judicial branch from any participation decision-making, has led our country into the extreme debt, the corruption, the war, and the downfall of President Bush and his party. So now I'm just going to give you a tiny little insight into what the unitary executive power idea, where it came from and why they developed this idea. It's kind of interesting because it came right back to the Nixon Watergate era. Cheney had already worked in the Nixon government a little bit, and then he worked in the Ford administration after Nixon was booted out of office. And Cheney very, very strongly felt that the president was under siege and was not being treated fairly by the world. So it's, again, a little ironic that what we're now paying for goes back to getting even because of Nixon. Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld together began to set out to find ways to get around the rules. They hated the idea that somebody was always checking what the president did. There was always somebody to slow it down, somebody to turn a new law into something else. And so they set out long before 9/11, when they came into office with Bush II, they had already decided to set out to try to reverse that trend toward Congress usurping what they thought the president's power should be. The much-discussed phrase called the unitary executive first gained wide use in the 80s during the Reagan administration, and partly because of Iran-Contra. Again, Cheney was involved in the Iran-Contra, some of you are old enough to remember, where a lot of truce-making and deal-making was going on that was secretive in the Reagan administration, and legislative branch was not brought into it. When that was investigated for the criminality of it, and some people did go to jail for it, Cheney wrote the minority report. And the minority report is pretty extreme, where, again, he complained that the presidential powers were being usurped by Congress. Cheney had a guy working for him named Addington. He was also known to be extremely conservative. A lot of lawyers who worked with him, even though they were also conservative, found themselves astonished by his radical absolutism. One later recalled sitting in meetings with him wondering, how did this lunatic end up running the country? His manner was insistent and loud. He doesn't believe there should be co-equal branches of government. Now, this talk was going on even before 9/11. Also, most of the people who worked in the Bush 2's White House in the legal department were participants in the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society is a group that was started pretty much in the early 80s as a way to counteract the liberal trend of what a lot of conservatives felt lawyers were all too liberal. They especially didn't like the fact that to get nominated to be a lawyer in the administration, you had to get approval from the ABA, and the American Bar Association, and they thought that was a liberal group. Orrin Hatch, our old friend, was a longtime leader in the Federalist Society. But it was started by Robert Bork and Edwin Meese, so those of you who enjoy politics know that those are two kind of way-out-there characters. It is said that the goal of the Federalist Society was to fundamentally reshape the landscape of the U.S. judiciary by promoting right-wing activism. Now, Flanagan and a guy we'll talk about more named John Yoo were very active in this group. You couldn't really be nominated to any White House position under Bush without the approval of the Federalist Society. Well, the Federalist Society also took this unitary executive idea very seriously. They took it from what most people consider a misguided interpretation of Article 2 of the Constitution. It's in Article 2 that the executive power is vested to the president. Conservatives took their idea more from the Federalist Paper number 70 by Alexander Hamilton, which conflated the idea of unity in government with executive power. And they felt that executive power was really, really the most important way that we could have some kind of unity, especially in times of war or foreign attack. In the opinion of this conservative clique, they believed that the president's functions were beyond the reach of legislative or judicial review, and they had to defy congressional demands for information and legislative attempts to restrict the president's use of power. Now, this idea, of course, is not supported by mainstream legal scholars. In fact, most people feel the whole point of the three branches of government was to protect us from the type of tyranny that the early founders associated with the royalty of England. We didn't want a king. You know, we wanted to make sure that nobody got that much power. One Bush appointee still in office called this philosophy monarchical. He said, secrecy was only one outgrowth of the belief, though an important one. Neither the public nor other branches of government had a right to look behind the curtain of the White House. This is a profoundly revisionist view of the American plan of government, a departure from two centuries of legal scholarship. Well, what was needed to really get this idea backing for Cheney was a war, and 9/11 gave him the war. So I hope I made the point now that he had this idea long, long before 9/11. It was not just the actions of that time that caused it to happen. In fact, the very day of 9/11, Cheney went to the White House underground bunker and assembled a war council while Bush was still flying around. Remember that airplane? The war council included Alberto Gonzalez, who was the White House counsel, and David Addington, who was Cheney's counsel, and a guy named Tim Haines, a guy named Tim Flanagan, and they called in a fellow named John Yoo, who was an underling. A lot of you have seen John Yoo because he's a Korean guy who teaches at Berkeley now, and he's the one who actually wrote many of these memos that are so controversial about torture. But he did it under the direction of this war council that I'm naming. One of the first questions Cheney asked in the group was, what kind of authority do we need to go ahead with this war? And they immediately called in you to write the legal structure so that nobody would question what they did. In a book called The Dark Side by Jane Mayer, she writes about this group, that they were like a high school clique. Some of the members played squash and racquetball together and took secret trips together while mocking those they excluded as soft leakers to the press. Well, within hours, Cheney had made contact with Flanagan, and Barton Gellman, who's also written a biography of Cheney during this time, calls Flanagan crucial in understanding what happened, partly because of Flanagan's conservative credentials, but more importantly, Flanagan had served as head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel under Bush 1. The Office of Legal Counsel, you'll hear a lot, OLC, so if I refer to OLC, that's what I'm talking about. They are basically the president's lawyers. And anybody who works in the OLC whatever they write is taken very, very seriously, because they're the ones who are supposed to make sure that the president has done everything he can to stay within the bounds of the law. Flanagan admitted he chose to go to you as the go-to guy on foreign affairs and military power. He was the one Gonzalez and I went to get advice on these issues on 9/11, and it just continued. They knew that Gonzalez did not have developed views on the separation of powers. Even though Alberto Gonzalez was the main lawyer for the White House, they basically went around him because they didn't depend on him. The following years saw the triumvirate emerge: Addington, Gonzalez, and Flanagan. Flanagan had the legal expertise, Gonzalez had the president's ear, and Addington worked for Cheney. A guy named Jack Goldsmith became a replacement after most of the scandal of torture had emerged. And he said that he found himself surrounded in the White House with two very experienced national security lawyers, David Addington and Tim Flanagan. He had heeded their advice. And he talks about Jay Bybee, whose name is associated with one of the main torture memos, more than one, but one is in particular. And he said, "I think Bybee was stunned when the legal foundation for his policy imploded in the spring and summer of 2004. And Gonzalez even said to Goldsmith, I guess those opinions were really as bad as you warned me that they were, after it was too late." Well, just really briefly, I'll tell you how a couple of the decisions came about. The first test for the War Council was the question of what to do with the captured fighters, because we were already attacking Afghanistan and capturing people. And so what to do with them? Addington immediately looked back towards World War II. He skipped over any treaties we already had, any new laws, and said that they didn't count in a time of war. Flanagan said Addington was their best scholar, so they shouldn't have to worry about any alternative viewpoints. But they asked you over and over again to write a memo to back up what they did, and each time he performed. This is how it came to be that any person we deemed to be an enemy was designated enemy combatant rather than prisoner of war. It was just a stroke of the pen, and it allowed us to disregard the universal rules that cover their treatment. We claimed that they were exempt from the normal humanitarian coverage and they had no human rights. Once we exempted them from that kind of human right, the next step was to loosen the means for interrogation so that we could gather more information from them. And that's how torture and inhumane treatment and the lack of any hearing or trial was allowed. The first so-called torture memo was secretly dated in August of 2002. It's known today as the Bybee memo because his signature and after the decision, although most people believe it was probably still primarily written by John Yoo, but overseen by Tim Flanagan. Even Flanagan was shocked at how easily they got permission from President Bush for these radical behaviors. "I was astonished," Flanagan said. "David and I were huddled in my office, realizing that the bureaucracy was not going to be a bit pleased to see the president act this way on his own without their blessing and without the interminable process that goes along with getting such a blessing." But he thought that was a pretty good thing to do. Every once in a while, it's healthy for the president to do this. It shakes the bureaucracy up. It shows them the need to move quickly to meet his policy objectives. So he thought it was good that the president signed something without reading it, that the legislature, State Department, nobody got a chance to review. Another secret memo in September of 2002 declared that the president had the prerogative to take any military action he deemed necessary, including preemptive action, and not just in response to 9/11 attacks, but any future attacks by anybody we refer to as terrorists anywhere. This is how the war on terror became so actually strange, is that a war on terror is by definition unwinnable and unending. You know, anybody that we want to call a terrorist forever is always going to be an enemy, and the president then can do whatever he wants to them. And so he can always stay on a war footing, which gives him the power to say, if he's questioned, to say, well, we're at war, so I have to have secret memos and secret plans. Now, I'll just say just a word or two about Tim and Jay. I will say one personal thing about Tim, and that's that when he first went to work for John Ashcroft and for Alberto Gonzalez in the White House, he actually told everybody in Gospel Doctrine in our ward how wonderful it was to be in a situation in which there was prayer at work, and how beautiful it was to go in the morning and everybody would kneel and have an early morning prayer, not just Mormons, but the born-again Christian that Ashcroft was, and so on. and that you really felt that you were, you know, keeping the Spirit with you throughout your day's work. Now, the day he said that, none of us knew that their day's work included writing torture memos. Well, Flanagan at the time was about, they say he was 48 at this time, so he's in his 50s. Some of his resume is perfect. He was law clerk to Warren Burger. He was had worked in the first Bush one. He really had a lot of experience. And speaking of the way Cheney was able to get Bush to go along with these secret legal orders, they say that one of the most shocking legal orders stripped foreign terrorists of access to the courts, and they didn't ever get approval from Congress or the courts. They ignored international treaties. And in this case, Ashcroft was said to be furious when he was told that they had done this without his notification. He was the Attorney General of the United States, and they didn't tell him. It was clear he was to be disregarded. He said that Cheney took it into a lunch with Bush and came out with it signed and just kind of gave a smirk and a thumbs up to Flanagan and to the others. What they did then was the CIA wanted more legal support. They said, it's not enough that you've told us we can torture. We want to know specifically how. We don't want any of our people to get in trouble later. So they began making the torture memos even more specific to support the CIA. And that's where we get the word enhanced interrogation techniques. They allowed nearly any type of physical or psychological distress as long as you accepted the fear of imminent death. If you really believed you were going to imminently die, or they waterboarded you to the point where you almost did, that was going too far. Some things that they were considering doing and supposedly didn't do is dig a grave and actually put you in it and put dirt on you and then pull you back out. Apparently, they decided that was too close to imminent death. So there, you know, they had some limits. Speaking of the torture memos, you said Addington and Flanagan assisted in the preparation of the memo, with Gonzalez attending the meetings. You did the writing, but the triumvirate reviewed the major lines of argument and portions of the draft. And you, by the way, is not LDS, but he's very closely associated with Orrin Hatch. Hatch named him earlier in his career to be the general counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and his rapid rise through the ranks is well connected with LDS Republicans. And Jane Mayer, again, back to her writing, she said, Flanagan, too, was more important than most people realized because he was the one with inside knowledge of the OLC, having run it, and he used that. The bottom line is that when you have the Department of Justice, you don't really need anything else. They understood this. Flanagan himself, some of you may recall this, that he was actually nominated when Alberto Gonzalez moved up to be Attorney General. Flanagan was nominated to be his assistant, and he had congressional hearings and very quickly pulled out because by then it was becoming clear that torture was known about and was beginning to be an issue and what was his role in it and so forth. But before he pulled out, the Washington Post criticized in an editorial the kind of answers he was giving. They said, how Flanagan can piously repeat the administration's insistence that it does not engage in torture. And by the way, the reason that they could say they didn't engage in torture was because they engaged in enhanced interrogation, not torture. Yet, following the administration's disgraceful line, says the Post, Flanagan has refused to say that that conduct is torture, which is banned by treaty and is a stain on American honor. It's either illegal or improper when inflicted on foreigners overseas. Flanagan could not even bring himself to declare particularly barbaric interrogation tactics, either legally or morally off-limits. He says he does not believe that the term inhumane treatment is susceptible to a succinct definition. The Post finished their critique by saying that words like odious and evasive legalisms applied to Flanagan. One of the other things they said in the torture memos was that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply because they were obsolete, quaint, and irrelevant to the war on terror. An unnamed source said Addington and Flanagan were behind that statement. And now just a tidbit more on Jay Bybee. Bybee's opinion, a lot of people give him a little bit of a walk saying that he didn't really know very much about war. He didn't know about the unitary executive theory very much, but he tended to follow, even though he was the boss, by the way, he tended to follow what others told him. And many of the memos were written by you under the direction of Flanagan and then just presented to Bybee for a signature. On the other hand, there are some people who say that's not entirely true. While John Yoo did most of the staff work for Bybee, Yoo was barely 35 years old, and his memos showed it. They not only took extreme positions, they were legally incompetent, failing to consider many of the obvious counterarguments. But Bybee was 49. He was the grown-up. He was a seasoned jurist. He had been a law professor, yet his opinion on torture was so poorly reasoned it was repudiated by his very conservative successor, Jack Goldsmith. Bybee has never been held accountable for his distortions of the law. His refusal to reveal his role at his Senate hearing would not insulate his actions from further scrutiny. The Constitution does not permit the Senate to throw Bybee in jail. If it convicts him, the Senate can only remove him from office and disqualify him from future service. Now, the person writing this goes on to call for his impeachment because Bybee was actually out of his office before all the torture came to light and was made a federal judge in the, I believe it's the Fifth Circuit.
Ninth,
thanks. Does he, and he lives in California?
Las Vegas.
So he was, Bruce Ackerman, who's a famous, influential law professor at Yale, has recently, in January of this year, called for his impeachment. He said his impeachment focuses on a very particular problem. Is J. Bybee's continued service on one of the highest courts in the land consistent with his role in the systematic perpetration of war crimes? The House should open an impeachment inquiry. In another interesting situation that I recently learned about, Bybee in the last year went to speak at Yale Law School, and many students came into his talk in the back of the room, put black garbage bags on their head, and stood like this during his talk. This is the kind of treatment that J. Bybee can expect to have for the rest of his life. He will always be known as a torturer. One interesting thing that I found that when he was nominated to the federal judgeship, one of those Mormon online groups, Meridian, mentioned that Bybee was a great guy, but that he worked on controversial subjects. But they reported that Bybee responded, "I would like my headstone to read, he always tried to do the right thing." So just a little bit now about torture itself. Once torture became established, we find some other Mormons that come into the picture. And I don't know as much about them. Some of you may know more than me. You may note that Boyd Peterson wrote a little bit about this in a recent Sunstone issue in the summer, I think it was. These two fellows are named James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. They're psychologists. This is a particularly creepy pair of Mormons, but very little is known about them. They emerged when the military minders at Guantanamo were looking for help in how best to coercively interrogate. So now they knew they were able to interrogate, but they wanted more specifics. They turned to a military program that has been set up in the past to train our soldiers to withstand torture. The program is called SEER, S-E-R-E, acronym. SEER stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. And what they do in this particular program is take some of our very top flight, I don't know what you call the, you know, the kind of rangers and top flight soldiers who are trained. They waterboard them, they drop them in scary places, they do all sorts of things to them and teach them how to survive so that if they're ever captured themselves, they can survive it. A lot of the techniques that were used in this program are taken from things that happened to our soldiers in World War II, like, you know, by the Asians or by the Russians or so on. So these two guys as psychologists, had had a lot of experience with the SEER training, so they turned it back and took some of the techniques and turned them back to use on the prisoners that we were putting in Guantanamo. Although others say that besides the SEER program, something else had a special impact on them, the TV show 24. Even Supreme Court Justice Scalia mentioned the effectiveness of Jack Bauer. and wondered why our country wasn't able to be as effective. The two psychologist Mormons played a central role and, in a statement, have said, "We are proud of the work we have done for our country." They have also said they resolutely oppose torture, have never endorsed or would endorse the use of interrogation methods designed to do physical or psychological harm. But a big article was written about them a year or so ago in Vanity Fair, who said that they were little experienced in torture. They were completely inexperienced in conducting interrogations. They had never done those. They had taken a basic approach, which was to break down detainees through isolation, white noise, take away their ability to predict anything that was going to happen to them. It's called learned helplessness. And the problem is that the psychological data for doing this has only been done like on animals. It's a way to train dogs. And so these guys were adapting this program into humans. They became so controversial that their names were a litmus test for one's attitude on torture. Their critics referred to them as the Mormon Mafia and the Poster Boys, referring to the FBI's most wanted poster where they thought they might end up. Critics say the program was not just morally wrong, but tactically wrong, and that it was trying to get, at the time it was used for our soldiers, it was to try to get them to sign propaganda papers of the sort that John McCain, you all know that John McCain broke in his Vietnam time, and he signed a confession of sorts. Well, that was the goal of that type of torture. But we weren't trying to get these people to break and sign a paper, whether it was false or not. We were trying to actually get real-time information, and it was totally ineffective. One blog has given these two Mormons the Dr. Mengele Award for their lying, delusional, scared of being prosecuted for war crimes, and faith-based approach to torture. Jane Mayer called them good-looking, clean-cut, polite Mormons, and very difficult to understand because of that. Now, you might wonder, moving on a little bit, are people sorry? Is anybody sorry for what happened? Cheney was just interviewed in the Washington Times on December 18th. Maybe some of you saw this. He was totally unrepentant. He said, "After 9/11, we badly needed to acquire good intelligence. That's an important part of fighting a war. What we did with respect to Al-Qaeda, high-value detainees, I think there was only a total of about 33 who were subjected to enhanced interrogation. Only three of those were subjected to waterboarding. Those three guys, that's it. Was that torture? I don't believe it was torture. We spent a great deal of time and effort getting legal advice, legal opinion out of our Office of Legal Counsel, which is where you go for these kinds of opinions, from the Department of Justice, as to what the red lines are out there in terms of this, you can't do this, or you can't do that." Now, am I crazy, or did you just hear Cheney blame Addington, Flanagan, all the people that he got to write his memos? He just dumped it back on them. How do they justify saying that they didn't use torture? One deputy assistant attorney general at the time asserted just this year that outrage against personal dignity does not necessarily apply to terrorism suspects. They have leeway depending on the identity of the detainee and the importance of the information. Geneva is interpreted on a sliding scale. And John Yoo himself in an interview lately said, "Well, I agree the language we used is not pleasing. It wasn't politically savvy. I didn't see that as my job." And Esquire says, "Well, didn't you have any moral qualms?" No, but that's the thing again. Just because the statute says, that doesn't mean you have to do it. You're right, there's still the moral question. Our job is to answer the legal question, whether you should do it at all. The other side of the moral question is the lives you might save by finding out what the number one leader of a terrorist group knows. From what I've seen, the country is evenly split or agrees that you should coercively interrogate someone like that. Or at least they used to think that in the year or so after 9/11. Interestingly, Obama has just replaced the whole squad, of course, of these lawyers with people who were incredibly critical of them openly at the time. One of the latest appointees is named Marty Lederman, and he's actually done a blog ever since the torture problem started, calling "How Low Can We Go?" And he said he believes that Gonzalez and Flanagan and the others conducted a conspiracy to violate the Torture Act. When responsible, thoughtful lawyers, loyal conservative Republican lawyers, mind you, told them what they'd approved was unlawful, they insisted the lawyers change their advice, and then they got rid of lawyers and hired another lawyer willing to provide alternative advice that no one could have sincerely believed. And then they rewarded the lawyer who was willing to sign his name to that advice. Well, I do have one little, I guess you call it sort of a joke about it that I saw. I couldn't believe somebody could make a joke about all this. But the joke said that Gonzalez confirmed today that the Justice Department was exploring the feasibility of torturing prisoners in outer space, exploring whether it would be legal if used on the moon. We could launch detainees from Gitmo into orbit in order to expand the menu of available interrogation options. Instead of detainees, we could call them de-astronauts, so they would no longer be protected by international law. Cheney says this is thinking outside the box, although a doctor says it will be a challenge to torture in zero gravity and keep the hoods on the prisoners' heads. Well, so what's the Mormon position on torture? Dozens of religious leaders have petitioned against torturing prisoners taken in the War on Terror, says a newspaper article that I recently was handed to me. This is actually from 2005. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, however, was not part of the collective call. However, the Church did issue a statement on its own. The Church condemns inhumane treatment of any person under any circumstances, but has not taken a position on any proposed legislative or administrative actions regarding torture. Now, that kind of makes sense. The Church doesn't like to get into politics, unless it's about sex, right? Or perhaps if it's something to do with
women voting
or
rights.
Exactly. Back in our day, the Church was really involved in deregulation of the airlines. They took a very strong stand on that openly. And I'll just make a couple of quick points about torture. In case there's any of you in here who still think, well, there might be occasional time to use torture, philosophically speaking, the only torture that can ever be morally justified would be the ticking bomb scenario that you always hear about. But everybody also agrees that there's no such thing as a ticking bomb scenario. So in other words, the ticking bomb is if, you know, we all might agree that if, let me change it to something closer to home, your child got kidnapped, there's a guy standing right there, he's the only one who knows where your child is. Would you torture him? Probably. I would, you would, any of us would. But the point is that kind of situation never occurred during this war. Most of the people that were there had no, you know, immediate knowledge of anything. The knowledge they did have could easily be gained from them by normal interrogation. In fact, my husband's brother was an interrogator because he speaks Arabic, went to both Bagram in Afghanistan and to Abu Ghraib in Iraq, and he said he never had trouble getting information from anybody he ever interrogated. They were happy to have a cup of coffee and somebody to speak Arabic with. So it's very hard to imagine that anybody needed to resort to that kind of situation. I'm just going to name a couple of more current situations, and then I think we'll have time for a little bit more discussion. So just January 20th, 2009, a newspaper article, "Dramatic Changes in Justice Department's OLC, Don Johnson, Martin Lederman, David Barron appointed, all have said that Bush's policies were justified by flawed legal reasoning. Obama flatly repudiated all the government legal advice on interrogation that has been issued from that department between 9/11/01 and January 20th, 2009. Did you know he did that? At a stroke of the pen, any legal advice from that department for that all those last 8 years disregarded. These lawyers that Obama put in have compared Bush's attorneys to mafia lawyers, and they argue that the notion of overriding war powers of any sort is a modern invention with few roots in precedent or in the Constitution. The Bush's position was a radical attempt to remake the constitutional law of war powers. They've called it illegal. They've said that it's a conspiracy. Here's another article from November. For the first time, a federal judge ordered the release yesterday of detainees from the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo after evaluating and rejecting government allegations that they were dangerous enemy combatants. Last night I spoke to Brent Rushforth, who many of you know. He is pro bono representing 7 prisoners at Guantanamo right now. I said, are any of them guilty of anything? He said, I don't know, it's hard to say. One of them seems a little tougher than the others. But most of them just seem like young, uneducated Yemeni guys who are just scooped up, you know, on the streets. There is still some people defending torture. Just a week ago, the former Bush speechwriter, Mark Thiessen, I think you say his name, He wrote an editorial in the Washington Post in which he warned that we have been safe for 2,688 days due to the use of Bush's tools and techniques, including torture, that have protected the country. Without them, we risk catastrophic consequences. So the next time we have some kind of event, are we going to turn back to torture? I also saw an interesting article that the public supports closing Guantanamo. 53% want it closed, but 69% of Republicans still want it left open. 58% of the general public oppose the use of torture, but 55% of Republicans still consider it useful. Dana Priest wrote in the Washington Post again a week ago, Bush's war on terror comes to a sudden end. He signaled to the world that the reach of the U.S. government in battling its enemies is not limitless. He reversed Bush policies on detention and interrogation. Obama said, the orders that I signed today should send an unmistakable signal that our actions in defense of liberty will be as just as our cause, and we the people will uphold our fundamental values as vigilantly as we protect our security. And I'm going to even quote John Stewart last week. John Stewart said on The Daily Show, he said, if we don't defend our deeply held values in times of war or times of stress, then can they be called values or were they only hobbies? Well, let me just say a little teeny bit about what would make people behave this way. Brent last night said maybe it's the culture of obedience that we instill in the church. We know that we're Mormons are often thought of as good followers, good CIA agents and FBI agents and so on. Maybe is it also, I hate to say this, but I would say that Flanagan's was a little bit arrogant, a little bit self-righteous, a little bit sure that his convictions, because they were prayerful, because he got on his knees, then his convictions must be better than other people's convictions. And Mormons are a little bit trained like that. We think we're a little bit special. But also, I read an interesting paper on community in general. Community is very, very important in the sense of helping people form some kind of restraints about their behavior. If you don't have a solid sense of community, you tend to get juvenile delinquency. You get people behaving in all sorts of, you know, bad ways. You see some of these countries that we're worried about, Nigeria, that's, you know, a kleptocracy practically because doesn't seem to be a strong bond between people to work together. But there's a downside to community, too. And the downside is that if you don't have a variety of thinking in that community, then everybody becomes sort of groupthink, right? One definition of a cult is that everybody thinks exactly alike. And sometimes I wonder if that's not what we've evolved to a little bit in the church, is that we tend to have very little diversity. That doesn't mean that we don't get people from different cultures or different backgrounds, but once we get in the church, then there's a pretty heavy molding process to get us all to think alike. Just last week in my ward, the Relief Society teacher spoke about Prop 8, assuming that everybody in the room agreed with her, and I finally raised my hand and made it clear I didn't agree with her, and she was shocked. You know, in fact, she had tears in her eyes because she was so shocked that this, you know, idea was coming out of a member. And not only that, but I had several people email me afterwards saying, thanks for speaking up, but how hard it is to be the one outlier in a group if you, you know, feel. So could this be a reason that Flanagan and Bybee would go along with these ideas? Did they just want the respect of the people above them? They wanted to please Cheney. They wanted to please their bosses. You know, I don't really know, but I do know that diversity and a broad variety of human types and styles is the one thing that keeps us honest and keep, you know, make sure that if we do have an idea, somebody argues against us and we have to hear about it. But what I'd like to do for the next, we just got maybe 10 minutes. I'd like to hear from you about that or anything else. Okay.
I think that we have a long history in the church of doing precisely that very thing, using semantics to lie about our actions, from polygamy all the way down. I mean, these guys were lying for the Lord in their own view.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Kurt?
My question is, have we heard either Tim or Jay say that these were their personally held beliefs, or have they always explained it that I was just doing my job?
Well, as far as I know, they haven't explained it at all. I know that Jay has refused to speak about it, hasn't repudiated it or spoken publicly at all. Tim has given several brief interviews to newspapers wherein he seems to not, he doesn't believe that they use torture. He just sticks with the story that what they did was enhanced interrogation and it was effective. And so I don't see any signs that they're repentant in any sort just yet.
I want to know you're saying the term enhanced interrogation. I mean, I've had a patient one time, scars on his legs. He was electrically tortured in Germany, by the Nazis. That's torture. What are you saying, what are the actual tortures that you're talking about that are included in the enhanced interrogation? I heard you said the drip thing, the water thing. But, I mean, really, how severe, how bad? I'm not saying that I'm condoning torture. But, like, when the guys were made nude in front of each other, yes, that's embarrassing. But to me, that's not torture. Okay, that's humiliation, but not torture. So what are we talking about? Because you're not really being clear, and I would really like to know the difference. And I'm not trying to be like gross or anything, but I really want to know.
Well, that's exactly what the CIA was asking these lawyers. They wanted to know too, more specifically. I will say that some memos have not been given out to the public yet. And there's a lawsuit going on right now by the ACLU. They say there's as many as 40 or 50 secret memos regarding the very actual specifics that have not been released. And so we're waiting to hear from them. I do know that most people in our country did not use, like, pulling out fingernails or, those kind of things that would be very obvious. But I also want to make it clear that the Geneva Conventions say that humiliating and embarrassing behavior of the type you use, that's also, we have signed treaties with the whole world saying we can't use that either. We're not supposed to use noise. We're not supposed to use stress positions, which we're using. We're not supposed to use lights on all the time by our signature in the Geneva Conventions.
So these lower forms of torture is what they're making a big deal out of? And I'm not saying that they're right. Because I hear all these other things about Guantanamo Bay and other places is that they have burgers. I mean, they have they're well taken care of also. But at the same time, I have heard, because I actually rent rooms to soldiers and they tell me things. And I have been told of one guy did start talking about how they had done some genital torturing. Okay, I'm not condoning it all. But I'm thinking, and they're totally wrong. I really is wrong, even to one person. But are we talking about this is like, has happened to five people out of all the thousands? I'm trying to get
According to people in the know, and I've got a lot of people who seem to want to respond to that, so I'll let them. But several people have told me that they were, of course, we know that waterboarding is the one that comes up quite often, and everybody who's experienced that definitely feels that's torture. Stress positions, which is standing in one place for hours on end and not being allowed to sit down, those kind of things. They may not seem as serious to you, but they are considered torture by international law.
I'm not disagreeing.
That way back there, you seem to know something.
We can't hear the comments from the audience. Whoever's the group rather than just you.
Okay. Or if they would like to come to the microphone so that people in the back can hear.
Let me just repeat for now what she said, which was that she's just concerned about, are we talking about real physical torture, or is there some line to be drawn with the more, lesser forms of torture in which people are just embarrassed or humiliated? Or
what percentage? What percentage of people?
Omar?
I just want to know.
Well, it's not just the percentage. They're keeping secret all the people we send to third world dictatorships. We contracted out most of the torture. So we said we don't torture, and that's how they're getting around it. But people who were sent to Uzbekistan or Jordan or Egypt and Syria, and there were a lot that were tortured physically, cigarette burns, electric shock, real torture. And we said we don't do it. We paid them to do it so that we wouldn't get our hands.
In the back, could you hear that? He's talking about rendition. He's saying that in some cases we contracted out, in fact, in many cases, we contracted out the torture by rendering people back to other countries in which the harsher forms of torture were used. Way back there.
Thank you. Well,
Speak up, please.
I mean, two things. In the church, we accept better that one man shall perish. And so these guys really think they're doing their job. But number two, they can repudiate and illegitimize, but it is the current administration's responsibility to prosecute and to create accountability so that we don't return to this. Again, I mean, are there thoughts on that? Should these guys go to prison? Not just lose their cushy 10th Circuit court job, but end up in prison. Is that a possibility? Is it going to happen? Should it?
Well, there's certainly many people who are talking about it. Eric Holder, who is the new nominee to be the Attorney General for Obama, supposedly he struck a deal to not go backward. He said one of the conservative senators who was opposed to him withdrew his opposition, supposedly because Holder said, I'm not going to look back. I don't think that's good for the country to spend all of our time looking back. I'm going to look forward. But there are other people who think that they might go ahead and prosecute you.
To get to your topic about the Constitution hanging by a thread, one of our articles of faith states that we believe that Christ will return and personally reign on this, the American continent. Mm-hmm. So I think that for a lot of Mormons, they see the Constitution as just a temporary kind of thing that can be set aside in preparation for the reign of Christ. And maybe that's why Mormons, you know, see it that way. We can do anything we want to because it's only the Constitution, it's not Jesus. I've heard my mother say, well, America is going to be the Lord's base of operations, as though it's a, you know, political campaign.
Uh-huh.
And I think that there may be many members of the church who see it that way. You can trample the Constitution if you think it's, you know, for the long-term reign of Christ, perhaps.
Kind of similar to how some Mormons don't worry about environmental rules because Christ will come before we have to worry about the economy, the environment. Yes.
Recently, well, for a decade at least in the church, I've heard said from the pulpit that the first principle of heaven is obedience. And I wonder how much this sort of attitude would have percolated down to the Flanagans and the Bybees and the rest of us, that we are not supposed to do except what we're told to do.
Well, I know that most of us are taught to be pretty good little obedient kids growing up in Utah, so, I mean, of course, most people are taught to be obedient. Maybe it's the exceptions that are able to stand out. Maybe most of us would do this if we were put in this situation, do you think? Anybody care to say?
Well, you know, she's talking about the Geneva laws and all that stuff, and I have to learn a lot of those things with my job, and I'm sure a lot of you are government workers too. But there are points where, and we all know this, if you're given an order that you don't think is a right order, you can disobey it.
But that only applies to prisoners of war. That's the point of the administration, that the Geneva Conventions only apply to prisoners of war. By declaring them enemy combatants, they don't fall within the Geneva Convention.
Right, it was a linguistic game, basically, to use terminology that made them have that exception. And the problem with that is that human rights then suffer in general, because as Mormons, shouldn't we be looking at human rights way, 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 way back?
I was just going to say, one of us just made a comment here that when federal employees sign on to work for the government, they take no government constitution. So how do these employees justify this as defense of the Constitution, whether they're Mormon or not?
Well, this is what I'd like to hear, not only from these particular people, the Mormons, but everybody who believes in this theory, the unitary executive. The thing that seems strange to me, actually, is that Cheney seemed very justified in wanting a very strong, powerful presidency as long as his president was in power. Does he feel the same now that a Democrat's in power? I'd like to hear. Does he feel that Obama now should be free to do whatever he wants, damn the consequences? I don't know. Renee.
Do you think that they called it a war on terror instead? Because you can't have a war on terror. I mean, you know, it's not logical.
Right.
Because terrorism is an act.
Right.
And it's not a state or anything like that. It's people, you know, trying to get attention. It's people trying to do something.
Right.
But it's not like going to war. Do you think that they turned that so that that would free people up to do whatever they wanted to do to rephrase the whole thing right. so that, you know, it gave power to the executive.
Yeah, I don't just think that, Renee. I know it. I mean, all the people are saying that that was exactly the purpose of calling it a war on terror, because that left Bush, he never did have to come to any kind of accounting for keeping Congress out of the loop. And Congress and all the committees were shocked, as the rest of us, to hear that some of these memos even existed. The thing was, even his legal structure that he had written to support him, he kept secret. So they could just say, well, we've got coverage, but we never were able to see it. I'd like to go on. I'm so interested in all of your opinions, but our time's up, and I know there's another meeting. So hopefully you'll let me know during the day some of your opinions on this. And thanks so much for coming to hear